Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the Colorado Business Digest, read by Michael Hesser, featuring articles from ColoradoBiz.com, the Denver Business Journal, and Colorado Business Review. I'd like to start today with an article from the Colorado Business Review, titled Colorado 2024 Mid-Year Economic Update. This is from Volume 90, Number 2, 2024. Editor, Richard Wobekind. Second quarter growth in real gross domestic product, GDP, accelerated in Q2 2024, growing at an annualized rate of 2.8% in the first estimate from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Personal consumption expenditures, which represent nearly 70% of the economy, expanded 2.3%. The pace of gross private domestic investment grew 8.4%. Government expenditures increased 3.1%, and the trade deficit grew in quarter two. The labor market continued to show resiliency too, with an average of 222,000 jobs added per month from January through June 2024, totaling 1.3 million jobs over the six-month period. Job openings, labor force growth, and low unemployment point to the continued strength in the labor market and strong demand for workers. The labor market remains strong through the first half of 2024, but there are a few modest signs of slowing. The job openings rate published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics increased slightly to 4.9% from April to May, but showed a year-over-year decline of 1.2 million job openings. The ratio of job openings to unemployed people has generally trended down over the past year, decreasing from 1.5 job openings per unemployed individual in May 2023 to 1.2 in May 2024. The ratio has remained above 1 for 37 consecutive months and has now returned to pre-pandemic levels. In addition, jobless claims remain relatively low. The civilian labor force grew 0.6% year-over-year, totaling 1.7 million in June, the second highest level on record. In June, the labor force participation rate was 62.6%, the same level as the prior year. Colorado ranked 24th for year-over-year employment growth in June 2024. The state recorded nearly 3 million jobs, 1.4% above June 2023 levels. The unemployment rate remained steady at 3.8% in June, tied for 31st in the nation. The June civilian labor force was just slightly below an all-time high recorded in December 2023, growing 0.1% year-over-year, ranking 38th in the nation for the growth rate. In addition, the labor force participation rate of 67.9% ranked Colorado fourth nationally in June. Heading into 2024, the Colorado Business Economic Outlook Estimating Committee's projected job growth of 41,900 jobs. At a meeting held in early June, the chairs of the 14 Colorado Business Economic Outlook Committees deliberated on the headwinds and tailwinds for each industry. The revised outlook for Colorado employment growth in 2024 is 49,600, with the highest growth rates expected in natural resources and mining, government, and education and health services. The estimating committee expects gains in all but three industries in the state, with forecasted declines in information, construction, and trade, transportation, and utilities. According to the Leeds Business Confidence Index, or LBCI, Colorado business leaders' optimism extended for another quarter to Q3 2024, driven by general economic conditions, politics, and interest rates. Leaders remained bullish on the state economy, industry sales, industry profits, and capital expenditures, but expressed some pessimism around the national economy and industry hiring. Other surveys, too, are beginning to reflect a potential rebound, and optimism is on the rise. The National Federation of Independent Business Optimism Index increased for the third consecutive month in June to 91.5, reaching the highest level since the end of 2023. The Consumer Confidence Survey decreased 0.9 points in June to 100.4 and remained down 9.7 points from June 2023. The Expectations Index decreased from 74.9 to 73 in June, remaining below 80, the threshold that tends to prelude a recession. The University of Michigan's Index of Consumer Sentiment declined to 65.6 in June, down 3.5 index points from the prior month within the margin of error, but up from 64.2 in June 2023. The Institute for Supply Management Services PMI registered 53.8 in May, signaling a general expansion among services. The manufacturing PMI has experienced a period of sustained contraction, consistently remaining below the significant 50 threshold for 18 out of the past 19 months, with a peak of 50.3 in March 2024, and most recently declining to 48.7 in May 2024. Colorado's economy is also just signaling resiliency as the state continues to outperform in terms of employment and income growth. Our next article comes from ColoradoBiz.com. It's titled, Kroger's CEO Says Shoppers Would See Lower Prices After the Chain's Merger with Albertson. It was written by Claire Rush and Deanne Durbin on September 4th, 2024. The chief executive officer of Kroger insisted Wednesday that merging with rival Albertsons would allow the two supermarket companies to lower prices and more effectively compete with retail giants like Walmart, Costco, and Amazon. Kroger CEO Rodney McMullen argued in favor of what would be the largest grocery chain merger in U.S. history while testifying during a federal court hearing in Oregon on the U.S. government's request for a preliminary injunction that would block the $24.6 billion deal. Quote, "The day that we merge is the day that we will begin lowering prices," McMullen said, while under questioning by a lawyer representing his company. Addressing another issue that has worried shoppers in communities with both Albertsons and Kroger-run stores, McMullen said Kroger was committed to not closing any branches immediately if the merger is finalized, but might down the road if it decides location changes or consolidations are needed. The Federal Trade Commission sued early this year to stop the merger the two companies proposed in October 2022 after Kroger agreed to purchase Albertsons. The commission alleged the deal would eliminate competition and lead to higher food prices for already struggling consumers. Kroger, based in Cincinnati, operates 2,800 stores in 35 states, including brands like Ralph's, Smith's, and Harris Teeter. Albertsons, based in Boise, Idaho, operates 2,273 stores in 34 states, including brands like Safeway, Jewel Osco, and Shaw's. Together, the companies employ around 710,000 people. FTC attorneys argued during the U.S. District Court proceedings on the commission's injunction request that in the 22 states where the two companies compete now, they closely match each other on price, quality, private label products and services like store pickup. Shoppers benefit from that competition and would lose out if the merger is allowed to proceed, they said. McMullen countered that argument by saying that Albertson's prices are 10 to 12% higher than Kroger's and that the merged company would try to reduce the disparity as part of a strategy for keeping customers. Walmart now controls around 22% of U.S. grocery sales. Combined, Kroger and Albertsons would control around 13%. Quote, "We know that pricing is going to continue to go down," McMullen said. His statements and the upcoming testimony of Albertsons CEO Vivek Sankaran were expected to be critical components of the three-week hearing, which is at its midpoint. What the two say under oath about prices, Potential store closures and the impact on workers will likely be scrutinized in the years ahead if the merger goes through. FTC Chief Trial Counsel Susan Musser referred to Kroger's 2021 Investor Factbook to make the argument that the merger would affect competition in areas where the two companies' stores overlap. According to figures included in the document, Albertsons is Kroger's biggest competitor in multiple metropolitan areas, including Portland. A Kroger attorney countered by saying that Walmart remains Kroger's largest competitor in a majority of markets around the country. The FTC and labor union leaders also claimed that workers' wages and benefits would decline if Kroger and Albertsons no longer compete with each other. They've additionally expressed concern that potential store closures could create so-called food and pharmacy deserts for consumers. Albertsons has argued the deal could actually bolster union jobs, since many of it and Kroger's competitors, like Walmart, have few unionized workers. McMullen said Wednesday that Kroger was committed to honoring existing labor contracts. FTC lawyer Musser said the merger still might affect working conditions, since union contracts are typically renegotiated every 3 years. Under the proposed deal, Kroger and Albertsons would sell 579 stores in places where their locations overlap to C&S Wholesale Grocers, a New Hampshire-based supplier to independent supermarkets that also owns the Grand Union and Piggly Wiggly store brands. The FTC alleges that C&S is ill-prepared to take on those stores. Laura Hall, the FTC's senior trial counsel, cited internal documents that indicated C&S executives were skeptical about the quality of the stores they would get and may want the option to sell or close them. C&S CEO Eric Wynn, for his part, testified last week that he thinks his company can be successful in the venture. The FTC is seeking the injunction to block the merger temporarily while its lawsuit against the deal goes before an administrative law judge. U.S. District Judge Adrian Nelson was expected to hear from around 40 witnesses before deciding whether to grant the request. If Nelson agrees to issue the injunction, the FTC plans to hold the in-house hearings starting October 1st. Kroger sued the FTC last month, however, alleging the agency's internal proceedings are unconstitutional and saying it wants the merger's merits decided in federal court. The attorneys general of Arizona, California, the District of Columbia, Illinois, Maryland, Nevada, New Mexico, Oregon, and Wyoming all joined the FTC's lawsuit on the commission's side. Washington and Colorado filed separate cases in state courts seeking to block the merger. Our next article is called What Colorado Homeowners Need to Know About the New ADU Law. Measure aims to boost supply of affordable housing. The author is Mike Koenig, written on September 9, 2024. In less than a year, it's going to be a lot easier to add an accessory dwelling unit, or ADU, in most of Colorado. That's good news for a state that's facing a roughly 100,000 unit housing deficit that's particularly glaring at lower price points. Colorado House Bill 24-1152, which Governor Jared Polis signed into law in May, goes into effect June 30, 2025. It aims to boost the supply of affordable housing by making it easier and less expensive for most Colorado homeowners to build an ADU, such as a casita, an in-law suite, or a granny flat. It also presents opportunity for those who have either been ineligible to add an ADU or for whom bureaucratic hurdles seemed too burdensome. That can provide for more personal elbow room or bring in rental income, even as it boosts a home's value by perhaps 35%. As someone who's been building ADUs in Colorado since 2008, I may be fairly viewed as a pro-ADU partisan, mea culpa, but the new law itself spells out benefits beyond rental income and property value. ADUs add housing units with minimal impacts to infrastructure and with increased compact infill development. They provide intergenerational living options and enable child or elder care and aging in place. Because they're small, ADU rents are typically low. They're typically more energy efficient per square foot than primary homes, and they run on electricity that renewables can generate. They often replace high water grass landscapes and involve less landscaping in general. And my own two cents, because the ADU housing tends to be in urban and close-in suburban areas where creatives and young professionals gravitate, ADUs often enhance their neighborhoods with youthful spending and social energy. HB1152 in a nutshell. HB1152 is mainly concerned with creating a more unified regulatory environment for ADUs across much of the state. It also puts $8 million toward making ADUs more affordable for low and moderate income residents. That money is in addition to the $10 million that Proposition 123 allocated for affordable housing, funds my company and others are giving back to ADU buyers as incentives, in our case, $2,000 for the first 40 we build, which we also match. To be clear, the new law won't apply to many of the state's rural and mountain towns. It's limited to those living in larger population centers under the jurisdiction of one of Colorado's five metropolitan planning organizations, or MPOs. But for most of us, HB 1152 is easing several burdens, mostly by addressing restrictions and conditions municipalities often place on would-be ADU additions. It prevents the blanket prohibition of ATU development in certain areas of town, as Fort Collins currently does. Basically, if there's room for an ADU, there can be an ADU. Further, with some exceptions, the law bars local authorities from requiring a dedicated parking spot for an ADU, as Boulder now does. That can save thousands of dollars in expanding a driveway, for example. It also forbids the requirement that the owner must live in the house associated with the ADU, though municipalities can require an owner to live there at the time ADU construction is completed, as Denver's updated regulations will do, or if applying for a permit to use the ADU as a short-term rental. In addition, it lets ADUs enjoy the same side setback rules as the primary dwelling would. For rear setbacks, it's either the same as the other accessory units, sheds and the like, or 5 feet. And finally, HB 1152 doesn't let municipalities require architectural style, building materials, or landscaping that are more restrictive than that of the primary dwelling. And it mandates allowing ADUs between 500 and 700 square feet. In other words, local officials can't apply a restrictive design or dimension standard to an ADU. Local governments still have their say. Local rules will still apply, however. With parking, for example, a municipality can require a new parking spot if the driveway, garage, or other place for ADU-related parking doesn't exist, or where there's no parking available for the ADU and on-street parking is prohibited. Historic districts can still intervene. Municipalities can limit the construction of ADUs less than 500 square feet and more than 800 square feet. ADUs larger than the principal home and multiple ADUs on the same lot. They can say no to motorhomes and the like. They can require statements from water and wastewater services that confirm sufficient service for the ADU. Most importantly, impact fees and similar development charges are still on the table. That can be a big deal, depending on where you are. In Boulder County, there's a town that hits ADUs with a $65,000 fee to hook into the existing homes' existing water and wastewater lines. Lyons, in contrast, charges nothing for that. Despite high interest rates, the financials work. Even in ADU-friendly places such as Lyons, ADUs represent a serious investment. All in, including utility hookups, the pad, and the furnished home, you're looking at $200 to $300 per square foot. For comparison, popping the top for a new second floor can cost $350 to $550 per square foot in Boulder and Denver. As examples, the mortgage payment for 500 square foot one-bedroom ADU at today's rates will be roughly $700 to $1,000 per month. An 800 square foot two-bedroom ADU would run $1,100 to $1,700 a month. Still, given the rents in Colorado's major population centers, rental ADUs are generally well in the black. In Denver and Boulder, the median rental price for a one-bedroom apartment is about $1,600, and that of a two-bedroom is in the $2,000 range. One can expect mortgage rates to fall as the Federal Reserve lowers rates, improving ADU payment numbers further. HBU 1152 is good for Colorado and its cities and towns, but it's also good for homeowners who can create more space for themselves in the communities they're tied to, or profit from building ADUs and renting them out in this house-scarce market we call home. Author Mike Koenig is the co-founder and president of Studio Shed, a leading modular home design and build firm based in Boulder since 2008. The content I just finished is a direct excerpt from the source material and does not represent my personal views or those of AfterSight. Our next article is also from ColoradoBiz.com, titled "The VIX and the Fed." The question isn't about the Federal Reserve cutting short-term interest rates at their September meeting, but by how much and why. Written by Fred Taylor, who is a partner, managing director at Beacon Point Advisors, written September 9, 2024. As we saw at the beginning of August, the markets have become more volatile as we head into the fall. This volatility is measured by the VIX, V-I-X, or the Chicago Board Options Exchange Volatility Index. For most of 2024, the VIX had traded between 12 and 15, but on August 5th, the VIX spiked to 65 during the day. In my 40-year career, I have only seen the VIX trade this high on a few occasions, the Great Financial Crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. This panic selling prompted the pundits on Wall Street to call for the Fed to immediately cut 50 basis points from interest rates. Today, the question isn't about the Federal Reserve cutting short-term interest rates at their September meeting, but by how much and why. Will Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell still be able to engineer a soft landing for the American economy, or are we headed for a hard landing? These terms were used to describe whether the United States could avoid a recession after 11 interest rate increases starting in 2022. Since Powell is the chair of the Federal Reserve, he is the pilot, and the plane is the U.S. economy. We certainly all know the difference between a soft or smooth landing when we fly, and we sure feel it when there is a lot of turbulence and a hard landing. We are hitting some turbulence now, and we'll only know what kind of landing Powell will engineer over the next 3 to 6 months. Let's hope it is one we like. Stock market. The markets have been counting on Powell to make this soft landing since the beginning of the year, and with a continued improvement on the inflation front, stock investors are quite bullish. The S&P 500 index is up 18% year-to-date. The Fed's mandated inflation target is 2%, and inflation is currently running right around 3%. The problem now for the Fed is the rising unemployment rate. It has gone from a July 2023 low of 3.4% to 4.3%. In his Jackson Hole speech, Jerome Powell stated, quote, "We do not seek or welcome further cooling in labor market conditions," unquote. If the employment rate continues to move much higher, investors are going to be calling for larger and faster interest rate cuts by the Fed. Higher unemployment could signal to the markets that the plane is coming in for a hard landing and that the economy is in a recession or headed for one. September 18, 2024. This is the date that we predict the Fed will announce either a 25 basis point or 50 basis point cut in short-term interest rates. Today, the Fed funds futures are predicting only a 25 basis point cut. The difference between the two moves is why the Fed is between a rock and a hard place. If they only cut 25 basis points, does that mean the Fed is still worried about inflation? Or if they cut rates 50 basis points, does that mean that the Fed is behind the eight ball and still worried about a recession? There will be another jobs number as well, and two more inflation numbers before their meeting to help them decide what to do. For now, the market is betting on a soft landing, but as we saw on August 5th, turbulence can hit at any time. For the time being, be sure to fasten your seatbelts. The information contained in this article is for general information purposes only. Forward-looking statements cannot be guaranteed. Our next article is titled Boulder Named One of Three Finalists to Host Sundance Film Festival. Decision expected in early 2025. Written by Lindsay Barr on September 13, 2024. The cities in consideration for hosting the Sundance Film Festival are down to three, and Boulder is one of the finalists. The Sundance Institute announced the three remaining contenders Thursday. Another candidate remains a combination of Salt Lake City and Park City, Utah, the latter its base for over 40 years. The third contender is Cincinnati, which would find the country's foremost showcase for independent film, putting new roots down, the Sundance Institute said Thursday. Eugene Hernandez, the festival's director and head of public programming, said that each of the finalist cities, quote, has shown us the blend of exciting possibilities, values, and logistics needed to provide a vibrant, inviting, and inclusive festival, unquote. For now, Sundance will continue operating out of Park City for the 2025 and 2026 festivals. Changes won't go into effect until the 2027 festival. Should the organization stick with Utah, the festival would center itself in Salt Lake City, with some elements in Park City. Local leaders all issued statements as well. Colorado Governor Jared Polis said that Boulder is, quote, the next natural home, unquote, for the festival, touting Colorado's creative communities. Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Puraval and Kristen Schlottman, the head of Film Cincinnati, spoke about the Ohio City's dedication to the arts and its ability to offer a, quote, dynamic, walkable, and accessible new venue, unquote. Finally, Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, Park City Mayor Nan Worrell, and Salt Lake County Mayor Jenny Wilson said they are eager to forge an even stronger bond to inspire artists and elevate the festival experience. The Robert Redford-founded festival has been a launching pad for many top filmmakers over the years, from Quentin Tarantino to Ryan Coogler. It's also premiered many eventual Oscar nominees and winners, including Coda, their first Best Picture winner, and the past three documentary winners, 20 Days in Mariupol, Navalny, and Summer of Soul. Last year's hybrid festival generated just over $118 million for the state of Utah, according to Sundance's 2023 Economic Impact Report. But there have been growing concerns that it has outgrown its mountainside ski town. The festival has long sparred with local ski resorts, Park City's other major moneymaker, as more than 86,000 festival goers fill the hotels and leave the slopes virtually empty for 2 weeks during peak season. In April, the Sundance Institute started exploring host cities outside of its longtime home. The three finalists were winnowed down from a list of six, revealed in July, that included Louisville, Kentucky, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Atlanta. A final decision is expected in early 2025. Our next article, also from ColoradoBiz.com, is titled Boulder to Offer E-Bike Vouchers to Income-Qualified City Residents. Registration opens for 2 weeks beginning September 16. This is written by the Colorado Biz staff on September 3, 2024. The City of Boulder is offering a limited number of vouchers for income-qualified city residents to pay for part of the cost of a new electric bicycle. Through these incentives, the city seeks to expand access to e-bikes, encourage more sustainable ways of travel, and continue to better understand the role e-bikes play in advancing Boulder's climate and transportation goals. The registration portal will be open from Monday, September 16 at 9 a.m., through Monday, September 30th at 11 a.m. and will be available on the program webpage. To qualify, participants need to be at or below 80% of the area median income for Boulder County. Participants will receive an email by September 30th at 5 p.m. from ebikesboulder@aptim.com, the city's contractor, confirming if they were randomly selected, waitlisted, or will not receive a voucher during this round, along with next steps. Selected participants will have 96 hours to submit proof of city residence and income. If approved, they will receive a voucher and have 45 days to spend it. Voucher amounts vary by e-bike type and income qualification. The 2024 vouchers provide larger discounts for the upfront cost of e-bikes, offering up to $2,100 for regular e-bikes and $2,700 for e-cargo bikes and adaptive e-bikes. To encourage safe, frequent use of new e-bikes, the city will also provide recipients with a $200 starter kit voucher to purchase bike equipment such as helmets, child seats, and bike locks. Quote, "We have seen a clear community need to offer targeted assistance for those who may find it difficult to purchase an e-bike without a discount," unquote, said Climate Initiatives Director Jonathan Cohen. Quote, "This program is one way we prioritize income equity as part of our climate actions, while also helping to improve air quality and community health through reduced vehicle pollution," unquote. Transportation and Mobility Interim Director Valerie Watson added, "We hope to better meet the individual transportation needs of our community with sustainable, convenient travel options, including by supporting community members making first and last mile connections to and from their destination. To support local businesses, vouchers will only be accepted at participating bike shops in Boulder County and are not valid for online purchases. A list of bike shops will be published on the city's webpage in the coming weeks. E-bike incentives are funded by the city's climate tax and supported by a partnership with local nonprofit Community Cycles. Visit the program webpage to learn more, access the media kit, and sign up for updates on the e-bike alerts email list." Our next article is titled, "AI May Not Steal Many Jobs After All. Technology destroys, but also creates." The author is Paul Weissman, and it was written on September 2, 2024. Imagine a customer service center that speaks your language, no matter what it is. Alorica, a company in Irvine, California, that runs customer service centers around the world, has introduced an artificial intelligence translation tool that lets its representatives talk with customers who speak 200 different languages and 75 dialects. So an Alorica representative who speaks, say, only Spanish can field a complaint about a bulky printer or an incorrect bank statement from a Cantonese speaker in Hong Kong. Alorica wouldn't need to hire a rep who speaks Cantonese. Such is the power of AI, and potentially the threat. Perhaps companies won't need as many employees and will slash some jobs if chatbots can handle the workload instead. But the thing is, Alorica isn't cutting jobs. It's still hiring aggressively. The experience at Alorica and at other companies, including furniture retailer IKEA, suggests that AI may not prove to be the job killer that many people fear. Instead, the technology might turn out to be more like breakthroughs of the past: the steam engine, electricity, the internet. That is, eliminate some jobs while creating others, and probably making workers more productive in general, to the eventual benefit of themselves, their employers, and the economy. Nick Bunker, an economist at the Indeed Hiring Lab, said he thinks AI, quote, "will affect many, many jobs, maybe every job indirectly to some extent. But I don't think it's going to lead to, say, mass unemployment. We have seen other big technological events in our history, and those didn't lead to a large rise in unemployment. Technology destroys, but it also creates. There will be new jobs that come about." At its core, artificial intelligence empowers machines to perform tasks previously thought to require human intelligence. The technology has existed in early versions for decades. Having emerged with a problem-solving computer program, the Logic Theorist, built in the 1950s at what's now Carnegie Mellon University. More recently, Think of voice assistants like Siri or Alexa, or IBM's chess-playing computer, Deep Blue, which managed to beat the world champion Garry Kasparov in 1997. AI really burst into public consciousness in 2022 when OpenAI introduced ChatGPT, the generative AI tool that can conduct conversations, write computer code, compose music, craft essays, and supply endless streams of information. The arrival of generative AI has raised worries that chatbots will replace freelance writers, editors, coders, telemarketers, customer service reps, paralegals, and many more. Quote, AI is going to eliminate a lot of current jobs, and this is going to change the way that a lot of current jobs function, unquote, Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, said in a discussion at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in May. Yet the widespread assumption that AI chatbots will inevitably replace service workers, the way physical robots took many factory and warehouse jobs, isn't becoming reality in any widespread way. Not yet, anyway. And maybe it never will. The White House Council of Economic Advisers said last month that it found, quote, little evidence that AI will negatively impact overall employment, unquote. The advisors noted that history shows technology typically makes companies more productive, speeding economic growth, and creating new types of jobs in unexpected ways. They cited a study this year led by David Ator, a leading MIT economist. It included that 60% of the jobs Americans held in 2018 didn't even exist in 1940, having been created by technologies that emerged only later. The outplacement firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, which tracks job cuts, said it is yet to see much evidence of layoffs that can be attributed to labor-saving AI. Quote, I don't think we've started seeing companies saying they've saved a lot of money or cut jobs they no longer need because of this, unquote, said Andy Challenger, who leads the firm's sales team. Quote, that may come in the future, but it hasn't played out yet, unquote. At the same time, the fear that AI poses a serious threat to some categories of jobs isn't unfounded. Consider Sumit Shah, an Indian entrepreneur who caused an uproar last year by boasting that he had replaced 90% of his customer support staff with a chatbot named Lena. The move at Shah's company, Dukan, which helps customers set up e-commerce sites, shrank the response time to an inquiry from 1 minute 44 seconds to instant. It also cut the typical time needed to resolve problems from more than 2 hours to just over 3 minutes. Quote, it's all about AI's ability to handle complex queries with precision, Shah said by email. The cost of providing customer support, he said, fell by 85%. Quote, tough? Yes. Necessary? Absolutely. Shah posted on X. Dukan has expanded its use of AI to sales and analytics. The tools, Shah said, keep growing more powerful. Quote, it's like upgrading from a Corolla to a Tesla, he said. What used to take hours now takes minutes, and the accuracy is on a whole new level, unquote. Similarly, researchers at Harvard Business School, the German Institute for Economic Research, and London's Imperial College Business School found in a study last year that job postings for writers, coders, and artists tumbled within 8 months of the arrival of ChatGPT. A 2023 study by researchers at Princeton University, the University of Pennsylvania, and New York University concluded that telemarketers and teachers of English and foreign languages held the jobs most exposed to ChatGPT-like language models. But being exposed to AI doesn't necessarily mean losing your job to it. AI can also do the drudge work, freeing up people to do more creative tasks. The Swedish furniture retailer IKEA, for example, introduced a customer service chatbot in 2021 to handle simple inquiries. Instead of cutting jobs, IKEA retrained 8,500 customer service workers to handle such tasks as advising customers on interior design and fielding complicated customer calls. Chatbots can also be deployed to make workers more efficient, complementing their work rather than eliminating it. A study by Eric Brynjolfsson of Stanford University and Daniel Lee and Lindsay Raymond of MIT tracked 5,200 customer support agents at a Fortune 500 company who used a generative AI assistant. The AI tool provided valuable suggestions for handling customers. It also supplied links to relevant internal documents. Those who used the chatbot, the study found, proved 14% more productive than colleagues who didn't. They handled more calls and completed them faster. The biggest productivity gains, 34%, came from the least experienced, least skilled workers. At an Alorica call center in Albuquerque, New Mexico, one customer service rep had been struggling to gain access to the information she needed to quickly handle calls. After Alorica trained her to use AI tools, her handle time, how long it takes to resolve customer calls, fell in 4 months by an average of 14 minutes a call to just over 7 minutes. Over a period of 6 months, the AI tools helped one group of 850 Alorica reps reduce their average handle time to 6 minutes, from just over 8 minutes. They can now field 10 calls an hour instead of 8, an additional 16 calls in an 8-hour day. Alorica agents can use AI tools to quickly access information about the customers who call in, to check their order history, say, or determine whether they had called earlier and hung up in frustration. Suppose, said Mike Clifton, Alorica's co-CEO, a customer complains that she received the wrong product. The agent can hit replace, and the product will be there tomorrow, he said. Anything else I can help you with? No. Click. Done. 30 seconds in and out. Now the company is beginning to use its real-time voice language translation tool, which lets customers and Alorica agents speak and hear each other in their own languages. Quote, it allows Alorica reps to handle every call they get, said Renee Pais, a vice president of customer service. I don't have to hire externally, just to find someone who speaks a specific language. Yet Alorica isn't cutting jobs. It continues to seek hires, increasingly those who are comfortable with new technology. We are still actively hiring, Pais says. We have a lot that needs to be done out there. Our next article, also from ColoradoBiz.com, is titled, Sports Boats Aim to Electrify Like Tesla. Just Add Water. Absence of Noise and Smell Appeals to Affluent Owners. By Michael Ledke. On September 2, 2024. Afloat on the San Joaquin River. Grant Geedy looked like just another dude riding the rollicking waves left in the wake of a 23-foot or 7-meter boat ripping through the water at speeds of up to 40 miles per hour on a river in Northern California's Delta earlier this summer. But Geedy was performing as aquatic acrobats behind a different breed of boat, one powered by electricity instead of gasoline. Unencumbered by the din and acrid smell of a combustion engine, the boat's passengers could chat with Geedy as he surfed behind them while they savored the afternoon breeze wafting along the river. It's like a playground back there. You feel like you could just ride all day, exclaimed Geedy, part of the sales team at Arc Boats, a 3-year-old startup embarking on a voyage to electrify the waters in the same way that Tesla led the charge to electrify the roads. As Tesla did with its first car 16 years ago, Arc Boats is starting with luxurious vessels, likely to appeal to a small and affluent audience that isn't reluctant to spend large sums of money to own the latest advances in technology. There are people like Jonathan Kuhn, a self-proclaimed geek who got rich after starting 1-800-CONTACTS in his college dorm back in the 1990s and can afford to splurge on the sleek, high-powered vessels that Arc Boats is designing and building. After spending more than $300,000 on a luxury cruiser called Arc One a couple of years ago, Kuhn is forking over another $258,000 to become the first customer in line to get Arc Sport, a model made for popular aquatic pastimes such as wakeboarding and water skiing. It's something that Kuhn wouldn't have considered buying just a few years ago after renting gas-powered boats and riding on the gas-powered boats of friends and hearing all about the hassles that went into maintaining them, along with the cost to fuel up vessels that usually only get a few miles per gallon. Quote, "My view on boats had always been that the best kind of boat is someone else's boat because they can be such nightmares," Kuhn, 54, said during an interview from Austin, Texas, where he's overseeing the development of a lakeside community. But that's not the case now. These guys just nailed every little detail on an electric boat that's just fun to use. Arc Boats CEO Mitch Lee is a longtime nerd too. He grew up in San Jose, California, the cradle of Silicon Valley, where he began trading in currency exchanges when he was just 8 years old. After moving on to Northwestern University to study mechanical engineering, Lee created a personal finance app called Penny that he sold in 2018 to Credit Karma, which is now owned by Intuit. That deal helped provide Lee with the money to start Arc Boats in Southern California with Ryan Cook, a friend he met at Northwestern. Electrifying boats has been in the back of Lee's mind since Tesla rolled out its first car, the Roadster, in 2008, and he wondered if the technology would eventually work on the boats he grew to love as the son of parents who loved to water ski. The success of Tesla's expanding lineup of vehicles and the electric cars made by other automakers finally created a supply chain of batteries and other parts needed to electrify boats, too. Arc Boats, founded in 2021, now employs more than 100 employees, including former engineers who worked for Elon Musk at two of his breakthrough companies, Tesla and rocket ship maker SpaceX. After selling only a handful of the Arc 1 luxury cruisers, Lee foresees being able to ramp up production to sell hundreds of the Arc Sport models across the U.S. annually. Besides its home state of California, Arc Boats is targeting other water-loving hotspots such as Texas, Idaho, Minnesota, Michigan, and other parts of the country with lots of lakes and people who want to have fun on them. The first Arc Sport is supposed to be delivered to Kuhn before the end of this year. There's a lot of enthusiasm for a product like this because it solves all these core pain points that gas boat owners have today, Lee, 35, said while piloting an Arc Sport on the San Joaquin River near Bethel Island, California. It's quieter, it's far more reliable, it's way cheaper to operate, you're not inhaling fumes off the back of the boat, and we're doing an interview on a boat where all you hear is the sound of the water. A wide range of other boat makers trying to shift away from gas combustion engines and fuel tanks that can easily cost $300 to $600 to fill for a day traversing a lake or river are making similar arguments. Some, like Sweden's Scandella and another California startup, Navier, are selling electric-powered hydrofoil speedboats that probably wouldn't work as well for water skiing or wakeboarding. A variety of other electric boats in a range of different styles are being made by a list of others, including Vision Marine, Ingenity, RS Electric, Duffy Boats, and Rand Boats. Compared to electric cars, the market for electric boats is a drop in the bucket. Worldwide sales of electric boats stood at just $5 billion in 2021, and even with steady double-digit annual growth, are only expected to reach roughly $17 billion by 2031, according to Allied Market Research. In contrast, global sales of electric automobiles surpassed $250 billion last year. Lee is trying to steer Arc Boats in the same direction that Tesla followed after barely making a dent in the auto market during its formative years. Just like Tesla's vehicles, the Arc Sport will be equipped with a variety of technology that will make the boat akin to a floating computer. The boat comes with display screens, sensors, Wi-Fi, a hydraulic system for raising and lowering the roof, a 226 kilowatt battery, and software that can be updated over the air. Lee envisions those software updates making it possible to provide people who own the Arc Sport with upgrades as the technology improves and potentially makes it possible for the boat to autonomously dock. The Arc Sport's hefty price tag is also an echo of the Tesla Roadster, which sold for $80,000 to $125,000. Now Tesla sells sedans in the $40,000 range, with ambitions to lower the price even more. Over time, we expect our technology to get less expensive, Lee said of the ARC Sport as he prepared to show off the boat's 500-horsepower motor. There are a lot of tailwinds here. Our next article comes from the Denver Business Journal newsletter. The content I'm about to read is a direct excerpt from the source material and does not represent my personal views or those of AfterSight. The article is titled, "The Rise of Digital and Real-Time Payments Creates Opportunities for Businesses," with a release date of September 16, 2024. As consumers continue to swap their cash and paper checks for digital payments, businesses are taking note. Convenience, speed, and security are driving the use of digital payments across all categories: online, inside a mobile app, through a peer-to-peer payment platform, and in-store via a digital wallet. They have become so ubiquitous that more than 90% of consumers said they used some form of digital payment over the course of a year, according to McKinsey's 2023 Digital Payments Consumer Survey. Experts expect the usage to continue to grow. The rise of digital payments creates opportunities for businesses, too. By embracing technological advancements in their payment systems, companies can offer consumers more payment options, boost efficiency, and reduce costs. If you ask some in the younger generation, they might not know how to write a check, says Mike Long, Vice President and Senior Product Manager for PreferPay, a Commerce Bank solution that helps businesses streamline digital payments to consumers. The trend is just going to push the market further toward digital payments. How businesses benefit from advanced payment systems. Embracing digital payments and automating payment processes begins with using application and programming interfaces, or APIs, to integrate a company's financial systems with payment gateways, financial institutions, and third-party services. Instead of sending transaction information to their financial institution in a single batch once a day and waiting for another business to receive information on how it processes, APIs provide a real-time data feed showing where payments are in their life cycle. Businesses also gain mobile visibility to their payments, which means they can process basic payments more quickly and more easily flag atypical payments for faster additional review, according to Joel Reddington, Senior Manager of Commercial Card Sales at Commerce Bank. When you get into larger organizations where departments are a little more siloed, Reddington said, electronic payment environments have workflows that allow employees to be in different offices on opposite sides of the country, or even different countries, and work together. Companies that need to issue payments to consumers, such as insurance companies, law firms, and healthcare organizations, see an increasing demand from consumers to make those payments digitally. Our data shows about 85% of payees choose digital payments when given the option, he continues. It's driving a digital-first experience and making it available to everyone versus forcing paper checks or your processes upon them. Businesses that implement new digital payment technologies typically also see improved productivity in their accounts payable and accounts receivable departments. The systems automate low-end tasks, freeing staff time for more complex work that drives the business. The next frontier, introducing instant payments. Digital payments are no longer the fastest option for consumers or companies. The newest evolution is the growing use of real-time payments, which move money instantly without the delays or holds that come with digital or traditional payments. Globally, 266.2 billion transactions used real-time payments in 2023. An increase of 42.2% over 2022, according to a recent report covering 51 countries by payment software company ACI Worldwide. This concludes our reading for today. Thank you for joining us at the Colorado Business Digest, read by Michael Hesser.